Blog Talk Radio.
Future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting upon the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well.
We're glad to have you back in the virtual studio. It's always
yes. I missed a
weird here without you.
An awesome show last week. You had the authors on of Transcendence, is that right?
That's right.
And it was a great show.
It was so much fun talking to those guys. And I guess the only upside to you not being there is there was less of us and more of them. So, you know.
I consoled myself with that because, you can have a show that's overcrowded with people and that would be a bad thing. So I'm glad that it was maybe a little more time for guests.
Well,
to,
but it's our
talk
show.
About
I mean,
that.
Come on,
but,
it's
yeah.
It's our show.
Well, I still
can't be
was,
crowded
with
us. We can't be crowding up the place.
I've never tried to do this show all by myself. You know, I would have to sock puppet you in some way. And that would probably turn out poorly. It sounded like I was crazy or something, which would be true. So,
you and Michael Darling did at least one show without me. At least one, maybe a couple back in the day.
We did two or three. But I mean, what I'm saying is, there's a sweet spot for the number of people on a show, and I think it's north of one and south of five. Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
well, frankly, I don't know if he's listening, but it always seemed a little crowded whenever Michael was on, didn't it? It always. I kid. It's a joke. Always,
kid because
always great right. Having Michael on. He can come back on anytime he wants. We'd always be thrilled to have him back. Just kidding around. So that was a fun discussion and a great show. And I don't know if you've had a chance to continue reading the book, but it's just a terrific book.
Great.
I had a blast through it getting ready for the show last week, and I've kind of returned to it since then and just kind of at my leisure hitting sections that I didn't spend as much time with. And it's just a lot of fun.
It's kind of that way. It's not like a straight through book like maybe, The Singularity is Near, where you read it chapter by chapter and it's a narrative that builds. This is a book that each section kind of stands alone, and there are a lot of sections in it. It's very well done, and highly recommend that book.
Yeah, well, I was enjoying it even before I realized I was in it, but I toyed with.
Yeah, you make an appearance in the book. That's great.
Yeah, I have the last word on the Rapture of the Nerds, and I asked them on the show last week. I said, whatever you change in the next edition, I hope I continue to have the last word on the Rapture of the Nerds.
The Rapture of the Nerds.
That's pretty good, being the definitive statement on that. But I toyed with last week, since you weren't going to be on, telling him before the show started that you were just really upset that I was in it and you weren't, and that you didn't feel like you could.
I stormed off. I said, I'll be in my trailer. you know.
Yeah, that's right. He's in his trailer. He's not taking any calls. Maybe next time you guys could put something by Steven in there. I don't know, you know, but that would have been funny.
Their response is, well, you know, tell him to say something awesome and we will. You know?
Yeah.
See, I just sock puppeted them, you know, and well.
Well, exactly. We don't need guests.
It can be done.
Exactly. Well, we got a fun one tonight, too. We're doing a grab bag, which we often do, but this one is thematic, which we sometimes do with grab bags. Sometimes grab bags are just purely random stories. This one is thematic two ways, okay? It's thematic in that these are all blog posts that I've written recently at The Speculist, so it's all my stuff. Is one of the themes running through it. And
I think that's Phil's way of saying, you know, Stephen, get in there and write some more. I think that's kind of your way of getting that across to me, right?
I didn't mean that at all, but it would be awesome, you know. But not my point. I was just saying that's kind of one theme, is it's a bunch of these blog posts I wrote. Or really, it's not even the fact that it's by me, but they're a bunch of speculative blog posts, right? They all came from the same source. The other theme is this idea of where do the possibilities come from, right? Beginning of the show, the spiel I give at the beginning, I talk about the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead. Well, where are those possibilities before they're articulated, right? And where are they when they're articulated? And when do they become real? You know, it's kind of this strange unfolding process of ideas turning into reality that we keep coming back to as a topic. So I thought, in addition to touching on several of these, I don't know if we'll have time to get to all of these tonight. We will absolutely do our best. In addition to talking about these ideas just as interesting possibilities for the future that we want to consider, we can talk a little bit about where on the spectrum, where on the timeline or the evolution from pure abstraction, pure idea to something that you might really encounter in the world, each one of these is. So that's kind of our, you know, the game show side of the show tonight. And since, as I pointed out, I wrote all these, Stephen, I'll let you have the final say on how far along each of these ideas is in the world. You get to be kind of the, reality judge.
And the answer is, okay.
Yeah.
I'll be that guy. Yeah.
Yeah, you'll be that guy. Exactly. You ascribe a level of reality to each of these. But before we go into those individual ones, I want to start with this one about, is there more value in data or in our tools for understanding it? Because I think that really kind of speaks to this topic a little bit. And I actually saw this on a LinkedIn post, or maybe it was a Forbes blog, but it was this guy, Bill Franks at Teradata, and he writes, I'm convinced that new information will beat new algorithms and new metrics based on existing information almost every time. He's talking about where the real value is in big data. You know, big data is one of the big buzzwords in business right now. Everybody's putting a big data strategy together, trying to figure out what they're going to do with all this data. And he's saying, if you want to know where the value is, it's in the data itself, not necessarily in the tools that are being put together to mine the data. He says, new information can be so powerful that once it is found, analytics professionals should stop worrying about improving existing models with existing data and focus instead on incorporating and testing that new information. Well, that just really resonated with me because in an odd way, I feel that echoes what we're doing with our book, The World Transformed, that new data, or in our case, new possibilities, new ideas, have a lot of power in their own right if you can discover them. You know, there's this whole process in data warehousing and analytics called data discovery. And I feel that kind of what we're involved in here is possibility discovery. We're discovering things that may be, futures that we may encounter. And it reminded me of something that I think we've talked about a few times before, but it was a talk that Eliezer Yudkowsky gave at the Singularity Summit in 2007. And it was along the same lines. He was talking about which would you rather have, modern hardware with the old software running on it, or the old hardware with modern software running on it, if you wanted to try to solve problems today. Obviously, you want today's hardware with today's software, but if you had to pick, which of the two would you pick? And everybody's like, well, you know, we don't want those crappy old computers from 20, 30 years ago. We would take the, you know, we would take today's hardware and settle for that old software. And when they do the calculations, it's interesting. Let me just read this. George Rose of D-Wave Systems recently was kind enough to provide us with a startling illustration of software progress versus hardware progress. Suppose you want to factor a 75-digit number. Would you rather have a 2007 supercomputer, IBM's Blue Gene L, running an algorithm from 1977, or a 1977 computer, an Apple II, running a 2007 algorithm? Geordie Rose calculated that Blue Gene L with 1977's algorithm would take 10 years, and an Apple II with 2007's algorithm would take 3 years. So, you know, it's like the 30-year-old computer using a modern algorithm was actually faster. So it's like our algorithms are better than our hardware, and the data itself is, you know, when I say better, I mean more valuable. There's more potential there. There's more potential in the algorithm than there is in the hardware. And there's more potential just in the raw data than there even is in the algorithm. So with that preface, now let's look at some of these amazing possibilities. I'm sorry, did I cut you off? Did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, I heard a recent story. Maybe it was Wall Street Journal that said that you know, honest to God, there's software that was developed during the Kennedy administration that the IRS is still running. I guess my question I pose to you, Phil, is that maybe that's a good thing? Do we want the IRS to be more efficient? I don't know. That's typical, I think, of you know, a government program is that it's conservative to the point of ridiculousness. They don't step out and try new things. They just, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, if you innovate, you innovate on top of it. You don't scrap from the beginning and start over. You just, you know, you add to. Take away.
The big takeaway for me there is they'd be better off if they're using that hardware from the 60s and put some modern algorithms on it, right?
Maybe.
Instead of using that crappy software from the 60s. But since you mentioned that, they have
a real problem apparently because it's in COBOL and they can't find people to do it to work on it anymore. But yet they still need it. You know, there's nobody around that does COBOL anymore.
Well, I'm surprised COBOL. I'm surprised it's not like Fortran or something like that. You know, even
it's old news.
But I was going to say, I don't know if I ever told this before. You know, when I worked for Sybase, I did product marketing for Sybase IQ, and one of our big premier marquee name customers that we could use as a reference back in those days was the Internal Revenue Service. And in fact, we even had a case study where this guy from the IRS was kind enough to refer to Sybase IQ as their, quote, secret weapon. And, you know, talk about a mixed bag marketing message to take around. It's like, see how good we are? Look, the IRS has endorsed us, and they say we're their secret. You know, people be like, yeah, that's great. Way to go.
I guess what you do is you present it to the right audience the right way. You don't necessarily put that to the general public.
You take it to the government agency, right?
It's a feather in your cap with the right crowd, but not so much with the general public. So
exactly.
Yep.
All right. Well, speaking of things that are a feather in your cap with the right crowd, but not so much with the general public, how's this for a segue? Let's grab one randomly here. How about this hallucinogens 2.0? Okay, that one. We got to talk a little bit about hallucinogens last week. RU obviously had some thoughts on this CNN money piece that we have linked over at The Speculist, a series that CNN is doing with the title, provocative title, Can LSD Make You a Billionaire? They're talking about the fact that apparently a lot of big, important people in Silicon Valley trip out on hallucinogens. They take them, and there's a claim that they make them more creative and that it makes a big difference in, you know, it provides, I guess, essentially a competitive advantage for these individuals who are taking these drugs. There's, the most famous, obviously, person who did hallucinogens and then became huge in the tech world is Steve Jobs. But he's far from alone, and as RU was saying last week, it's not over. He thought that was something that had fizzled out maybe as long ago as the 90s. And to see that it's either still going on or that it has started back up is something that that he was truly surprised by. Now, I got this wonderful quip from a story, I think in the Telegraph, the UK Telegraph, which was that many people tried acid, only one became Steve Jobs. I think, you know, there's...
Well, if there are more than one billionaire, though, that can point to LSD as a part of their an important formative event for them, maybe there is something to it, though. Maybe only one became Steve Jobs, but there's a number of billionaires that can point to that.
Apparently,
you know,
there are.
I don't,
And so in the piece, I call for we need hallucinogens 2.0. What we need is some kind of technology that's going to safely tap into the parts of our brains that hallucinogens do. And I don't know how that would work. I don't know if that would be a chemical or if it would be an electronic signal. But, if there's something valuable there that helps to unlock our potential, and people seem to have believed that for a long time. I mean, hallucinogens are part of mystical and religious traditions going way back and now have this interesting link in Silicon Valley. If there is something there, it's probably worth exploring, I think. But you want to be real careful, putting chemicals
absolutely.
In your body that mess with your brain. That's the...
I agreed. It's unfortunate, I think, that this particular group of chemicals has been completely, ignored, at least for research purposes, for a long time. Although that's less so now. It's being researched by serious researchers again, and some of the things that they're finding is that it seems promising for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. It seems mm-hmm. promising for end-of-life anxiety. You give someone a trip, they got maybe a month or two to live. You give them a trip, and they begin to feel a little differently about they're able to meet their end a little more, with a little less fear, and that's a good thing. So there are things that perhaps under the watchful eye of a doctor that should be explored. But again, kids, don't try this at home. So,
right.
We'll leave it at that.
Well, let me ask you, Stephen, if I came up to you and I had the electrodes, I said, well, look, Stephen, I got a hallucinogen 2.0. Okay, there's no drugs. I'm just going to strap this on you, and it's going to give you the equivalent of an acid trip, but no lingering side effects. You won't have flashbacks or anything like that, but it will give you the mock-up of that experience. Would you try it?
I'd be highly tempted to. The descriptions of trips that these people take are sounds like a beautiful experience. I mean, you're seeing music and you're hearing colors and Steve Jobs, he tripped different, didn't he? So,
well, he did everything different. Absolutely.
And maybe it did set up his brain to look at the world a little bit different after that, and it may have helped him contribute. So, yeah, I would be tempted to. I'd have to read up to make sure that what you're telling me is true, and that it's safe and things like that.
No,
but,
it's me.
Yeah. Come on,
You're fine. All the kids are doing it. Come on.
And the first one's free, Stephen.
The first one is free, exactly. All the kids are doing it. You won't be cool if you don't, and the first one's free. There you go. I've got my pattern.
Exactly.
Fantastic. All right, so what do you think? Where do you think we are on the scale from pure abstraction to a realized possibility? Obviously, we don't have hallucinogens 2.0, but do you see that as a viable idea, a likely idea?
I saw something interesting. You talked about electrodes. There's basically a skull cap these people were doing. It had a magnetic resonance in it, and it was giving people religious experiences. I mean, you put it on and
I remember reading about it.
As far as are we close to this sort of stuff? We have it. It's just you won't find this technology in your local Walmart yet, but. It exists in the world, and I think that ultimately it will be available if they can prove that this is safe, completely reversible, that kind of thing. So I think that this is highly likely to be that we see more of this. Absolutely.
I had forgotten about that. We talked about that a few years ago. That's a really interesting development, and. Yeah, you've got to think that that's touching somewhere near that, because a lot of these hallucinogenic experiences are described in those kind of mystical and spiritual terms, as though people are having some kind of a religious experience. Very interesting. We got to keep an eye on that and see if see where that goes. Because if there is a creative, competitive edge to it, right? Even if they don't work all the kinks out, that's something that people are increasingly going to be looking for, I think. Creativity being one of the final differentiators in a world where the robots are taking the jobs away, right? And until they become as creative as we are, that's the one thing we can sort of do. Okay, let's look at another one of these. Stephen, you can pick one if you want.
How about let's enable failure?
It's
something that's talked about a lot, particularly in tech circles and places like Google and things. Fail faster. And you're like, what are you talking about? Failure is something to be avoided at all costs, right? Well, that's kind of the old way of looking at things. But it leads to overly conservative and, behavior as an organization. If the main thing is don't screw up. If you screw up, you're gone kind of deal. Then nothing ever changes, and your organization is passed by, by other organizations or groups that are willing to take some risks, and so it's almost a resume enhancer in some of these organizations that, hey, he's can you believe it? He's failed at 5 different things. He's out there trying stuff.
Absolutely. I think it's actually not that bad to have failed at 5 things, because you've given, presumably, when you fail at 5 things,
yep.
and you come away with knowing an awful lot about how not to do each one of those things that that you failed with. But you hit the nail on the head. The faster you can fail, the faster you can get to an iteration where success will occur. That's the bottom line.
Right.
If you look at failure as a thing to be avoided at all costs, first, it's not realistic, because not everything's going to work. What you have to do is you have to make the process of getting an idea out there, of trying something, as light as you can. You want it to be as streamlined as possible. And that's why it's really interesting when they talk about agile development process. It's
right.
it's all about developing a minimum viable product, right? Minimum viable product, no bells, no whistles, the least this thing could be and still be what it is, and see if it catches
right.
on, right? Because that way you haven't gone through the whole development cycle that used to exist. You haven't. You haven't spent all that time. You haven't invested all that money. And if the thing doesn't work, you didn't put that much into it, and you're ready to try something else. Or more likely, you're ready to try a slightly different tack on the same thing that you've tried. So absolutely, the more you can try, which isn't to say let's just try every stupid thing, Right. I mean, you want to go about it.
You don't want to fail trying to build a perpetual motion machine. You know, because
right.
you know that's not possible. So you want to fail at things that are on the edge of possibility, that look like they might be possible. You know, maybe. And
right.
And if you fail, well, then maybe you've still pushed the envelope a little, and maybe you know a little bit better about where that line of possibility and impossibility lies. So, I would say that this, you know, the willingness to risk failure is one of the biggest markers of the winners in our society. And I'm talking about every aspect of your life, every single aspect of your life, down to, you know, your willingness to ask out the girl that you think is, you know, out of your league. I mean, everything. I would say that's just a mark of a winner. You know, and you'll winners will lose along the way, but ultimately they're the ones that have something to talk about at the end of their lives, as opposed to the careful person who never did anything. So
exactly. So what I've proposed here, is a brain hack. Okay, to make people more confident, because we got the methodologies now. You know, businesses are learning how to do this, but I don't know that individual people have really picked this up yet. So I'm suggesting, what if you had a brain hack to make people more confident? You know, just give them this certain belief, you know, this unshakable knowledge that they can do things, right? Not certainty
right.
that they'll never fail, but confidence that they really can make things happen, right? Which would make people, I think, more willing to try things. Good idea, bad idea? What do you think? Would you take a confidence pill if there was one?
Yeah, and I think confidence is a measure of maturity too. I heard something funny. You know, when you're in your 20s, you worry about what other people think, and then by the time you hit 40, you don't worry about what other people think as much, right?
Right.
And then by the time you hit 60, you realize nobody cares what you're doing anyway.
Exactly.
Everybody's worried about the other people, and nobody, you know, but no one's really actually thinking, you know. And so, you know, what would people think, you know, if I fail? Well, you know, who's looking? You know, nobody's looking until you get out and try something. So, you know,
absolutely. It's almost like if there's a way to just get people to stop distracting themselves with this fear. Right, that they're going to look bad, or if you could infuse that 60-year-old brain into the, you know, the 25-year-old who's got a lot of great ideas, but scared to death to try anything, right?
Right.
What do you think? Where are we in the world on doing something like that? Do you think that's a doable proposition?
The hack. You know what? I think it's a doable proposition, and it may be something, again, it might go back to the magnetic resonance helmet we were talking about, or
mm-hmm.
it might be chemical.
Oh, yeah.
There's multiple paths to success on that, and maybe somebody just has the courage to come up with the courage hack. Maybe it's a chicken and egg problem, Bill, you know?
It could be, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why we don't have one yet. Nobody has the guts to get out there and do it. Come on, somebody. You can make this. You can make this hat, and you'll make a ton of money off this thing too. I'll tell you.
People, you know, everybody has forgotten that Steve Jobs was behind the Lisa project, but everybody remembers the iPod. So, you know, get out there and try something.
Absolutely.
It's always a good idea.
All right, so let's talk about some of these others. You know, there's a couple of themes that do run through these now that look at them. One is kind of like boosts or modifications to the brain, because we've got the one about that we've just discussed, which is a confidence boost. Then we talked about hallucinogens 2.0. So why don't we kind of close that theme out with this one, which is the 10 to 20% brain boost. And, you know, Stephen, we've talked many times about how we boosted our intelligence tremendously through external sources. And you talk about how you consider Google a part of your brain. And there's no question that we are effectively more intelligent than people were in previous generations because we have access to intelligence that they didn't, right? We aren't more intelligent, but we're part of a more intelligent system than they were. Actually, if you look at the IQ scores, we're also more intelligent demographically speaking than people were.
Can I just share with you? I homeschool. My wife is a heavy lifter on it, but we homeschool our children, our four sons. And I'm going to tell you that the gift that we are attempting to give them, and it seems to be working. Timothy's going to college, by the way, this fall. Can you believe that? It's snuck up on me. It doesn't seem right.
Where's he going?
East Texas Baptist, the same place I met Sherilyn. We kind of toured the campus a month or so ago, and he just loved it. It's a smaller school. You literally will know everybody on campus, hometown kind of feel. He'll be 45 minutes away, which is far enough away that mom and dad are not going to be always over there, but close enough if he wants
close
to
enough
come
that
watch
where if you need him
watch
yeah,
close
exactly.
Yeah, so he's very much excited about that. But anyway, the gift that we're trying to instill is, that you are your own best teacher. If there is anything that you want to know, there's nobody that that is as motivated to put that in your brain as you can be. And you have a unique set of tools available to you now that we didn't have. I didn't hear the word internet until I graduated from college. And these guys, that's a big part of what they do. They, as they've gotten older, there's at younger grades, you have to know this at this age, et cetera, but as they've gotten older, we kind of, we allow a lot more freedom for them to pursue the areas that interest them. And, it's fun. And so we've had a good time with that.
That's awesome. Well, so what do you think if there was an external way to boost intelligence, would you encourage your son to avail himself of that? Would you avail yourself of that? And once again, I guess it's going to be it's this multi-purpose skull helmet that we'll be putting on with all the electrodes, right? But assuming there was something like that, we talk about there might be
there's at least
approaches.
One drug that there's a couple of drugs that are abused by college kids that actually and the reason they are is because they seem to work, at least with increasing your ability to retain information, things like that. But is it modafinil?
Modafinil, absolutely. Yep.
Thank you. Then there's a couple of drugs that allow you to stay up for days at a time with very little sleep needed. And, drugs like that can be abused. They're not a good idea. Kids get expelled if they're caught abusing these things. It's considered academic cheating. Here's the thing, does it matter that the guy that wins the is the star athlete in baseball abuses drugs? Well, yeah, it does, and then you get removed from the Hall of Fame. What about NASCAR? NASCAR, those guys, there's rules about the stock cars and what they do and don't do that are routinely broken. And when they discover that these guys are souping up their cars in ways that are not allowed by the rules, they go, you're not supposed to do that. And then that's it. That's, it's like that particular sport, everybody looks the other way. Where on the spectrum should this sort of thing lie? I guess it would depend on what the safety is and what the utility is of the thing that we're talking about. If you had a truly safe thing that could raise intelligence, then intelligence is a good thing. And, I think that it should be pursued. So, I think it just comes down to issues of safety at that point.
I think it probably does too. It's interesting when we talk about modafinil, it's really more of a performance enhancer than it is an actual intelligence boost, although it could be that we're just into a semantic discussion at that point. It could be that, you know, the ability to effectively, you know, usher your, marshal your intelligence is, you know, as critical to having it as having an innate intelligence capacity anyway. I mean, it could be that those are not separatable from each other anyhow. So if something boosts your ability to use your intelligence, then that's effectively a boost in your intelligence. But I think about something like, you remember the old science fiction story, it became a movie then later, Flowers for Algernon. I think the movie was called Charlie.
Right.
But about the, we used to say mentally retarded, I guess he was a man with a severe learning disability who has brain surgery and it makes him a genius, right? Now, he's not given, you know, the opportunity to really assess the risks because, you know, he's not in a position, you know, to responsibly take those chances. But in the story, he goes through this incredible transformation from this man who's confused and frightened by life to this guy who's confident and, you know, in charge and still very puzzled by a lot of, you know, what goes on in the world around him, because just because he's intelligent doesn't mean he immediately understands relationships and things like that. But it's like, you know, this whole new life opens up for him. And then later a side effect of the surgery is he regresses back to a state even prior to what he was before. And then I think eventually it appears that at the end of the story, he's not dead, but he's going to die, that it's, you know, that it's going to kill him. Well, nobody would think that's worth it, I don't think.
Well,
although,
I can offer an argument, you know what I mean?
Okay.
The brilliant, confident, and, you know, I mean, obviously Algernon, or Charlie, Algernon's the mouse, right?
The mouse, yeah.
Yeah, that they tested the procedure on first.
Right.
Charlie is not given the choice, but if he, you know, because he apparently wasn't intelligent enough to make the choice, so, but if, you know, would he have taken the 3 or 4 months or however long he was given over, you know, a lifetime of you know, being severely handicapped? I don't know. He would have chosen that limited period of time. It was, you know, obviously a good time for him. So I don't know. It's hard to say.
Yeah. So you think about a comparable, not really comparable, another scenario. Okay, you're 18 years old, you're you know, getting ready to go to college. Maybe you just graduated college, but you're not the brightest bulb in the pack, okay? You know it. You're a pretty average person. And they come to you with this procedure, and they say, look, this will put you into the upper 0.1% of the whole population of the planet for intelligence, okay? This will make you one of the smartest people on Earth. You can do this. There is about a 1% chance it'll kill you. You know, now, I don't know. Is it a totally irrational decision to say, actually, I'll roll the dice. I'll take the
Yeah. Well, how about this? You'll be the smartest man on Earth or the smartest person on Earth for, you know, 10 or 15 years, and then it'll kill you. And we know it will.
Right.
You have a 100%
right.
chance of death. You know, you're now 22. You'll be dead by the age 35. Your brain will literally have burned out because it's, you know, it's basically overclocked or whatever we're doing to you. And but you will you'll have a decade or a little more to change the world. And, you know, what do you say? I think there are people that would rationally choose that, even knowing that it has a 100% chance of killing them dying
right.
young. They would still, you know, I mean, it's the question of longevity versus being able to contribute. And
I
think
it
would be a rational
life issue around
to walk
intelligence.
Away. Yeah, it'd be a rational choice to either walk away or to do it. It's just it just depends on, I guess it just depends on the person.
So there's more at play than safety, I think, when you talk about this one, because ultimately,
yeah.
as you've said, this is the ultimate superpower. This is the
yeah.
real driver behind everything. If you can be smart enough, you can fill any other gap. See, I think the 22-year-old might go, well, yeah, make me the smartest guy in the world. I'll figure out how to not die in 15 years.
Yeah, exactly.
But the real problem is when you're 22, you think that's a long time away.
But you're the smartest person in the world.
Yeah, exactly. If you're 22, you think, oh, 15 years is a long time. As soon as they give him the surgery, he goes, oh, no, I've only got 15 years to live. I'm more intelligent now. I realize that I made a bad deal.
That was a real dumb thing to do. So, anyway.
Anyhow, so, okay, I think that we're looking at probably the same kinds of procedures around the three that we've discussed. And so, not to answer the question for you, but I'm going to say that seeing as transcranial stimulation is magnetic stimulation is one of the ways that they're talking about actually boosting people's intelligence. This one is kind of somewhere in the middle along with the other two. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. The possibility is, I think it's there. It's, there are huge ethical problems with every one of the things that we're talking about,
potential.
Yeah. You just have the potential ethical issues that are huge. And so, I think that reputable scientists will tread lightly, but we'll look into these things, but tread lightly.
All right. So the next kind of series of these is not so much about modifications to people, but it's these are all kinds of ideas for plans or projects, or I think a couple of them actually are described as push prizes. And let's talk about this one. Should there be some reward just for efforts to make things happen faster? And I got this idea. I was thinking, there is a Nobel Prize for chemistry, and there's one for physics, and there's one for peace. Those are all really noble pursuits. But how about just for whoever contributes most to things going faster than they did before? Because when you come right down to it, virtually all of the progress that we talk about on this show can be traced back to something happening faster than it did before. Maybe not every single thing, but almost everything can be defined in exactly those terms. If you can speed processes up, processes that are good, processes that work, you generate more value, you generate more goodness than you had before. Just the act of making something happen faster, if it's a good thing, right? If you're doing it without unintended consequences, without making something bad happen faster along with it, or making something bad happen that wasn't happening before, I say you're doing a good thing for the world. And it seems terribly general and almost kind of abstract, but maybe we should start looking at it that way, that maybe there should be a whole series of acceleration prizes that are awarded every year, and that we should focus on and celebrate those who are making things happen faster. What do you think?
Absolutely. And this is the sort of thing that could save lives. You mentioned agriculture, getting crops to grow faster. There's a guy, I believe, that was from Texas A&M, and I should know the name of this man. He's very important to the world, and he's one of these unsung heroes. But he developed a dwarf wheat that, normal size wheat, it has a stalk that's about a foot and a half, 2 feet. He created a dwarf wheat that has a 6-inch stalk, but a full head to it. So all of the grain, but with a much shorter stalk, and it grows faster because of that. And, more of the energy goes into making the food rather than making a stalk that you don't eat, right? And, so you're taking less nutrients out of the ground, for the amount of food you're able to produce, that kind of thing. And, that one development alone, it helped, there are people alive today that did not starve because of that one development. So that, you can think, what about in medicine or things like in our science? What if, you're the guy that comes up with a machine that is able to sequence a person's DNA, like in Gattaca, where the girl takes a swab out of her mouth because she kissed her boyfriend. She wanted to get a sequence done of of her boyfriend. Not necessarily a great thing, right? But, you know, how important would that be to medicine if you could, in 30 seconds, get have a complete workup of a person's DNA and be able to tailor medicine to the patient right in front of you? Acceleration, man, it's where it's at.
Absolutely. Well, I think there are so many areas that could be touched by technology where, you know, technology could just make things happen faster because inherently that's what computers do anyway. They get faster and they automate processes and they make them go faster. And then there are just a lot of things that happen in the world that take more time than they should have. My father was in the hospital recently, and when we were getting him admitted, one of the things I observed was just what a grueling process it was getting him admitted to the hospital. You know, I mean, we were coming from the emergency room to the, you know, to actually getting him into a patient room. And of course they have to do it, but you know, sadly he's been there before, so they knew most of this anyway, but there's this long set of questions they had to ask him. My poor daddy, he was just exhausted. And I could see what he really wanted was to go to sleep. But we're in this room, we're sitting there, and it's just like, and this, and did you do that, and have you ever had one of these, and have you? And I thought this process from the emergency room to here, you know, we were like 3 or 4 hours into it, my mother and I, working this with my dad, and I thought this should be much faster than it is. You know, they're already using information technology. There are already ways this could be happening faster than it does, and the benefit would be, you know, the thing you're putting a person in the hospital for anyway is so they can get some rest, right? I mean, you want to observe them, and you want to be able to, you know, take their vital signs, but also, you know, let the man have some rest. That's what he's that's what he's supposedly there for.
Well, what we really need is the tricorder, you know,
exactly,
and come back with, oh, here's what's wrong, and here's a little dermal hypo spray that'll take care of it.
And it would help if hospitals would believe what's in their own computers, right? It's like there's a rule that says they have to write it all down again. You know, it's really just from my days doing process management at the phone company. It's like it's a bad process just from a standpoint of duplicating a lot of effort many times over. They want to be thorough. I understand that, and there's a lot of, you know, safety of the patient and liability issues there. But it's at quite a cost, and I think there are a lot of day-to-day processes that maybe aren't as dramatic as that one, where you encounter the same thing. It just takes an awful lot longer than it should. I mean, I don't even get me started on like boarding an airplane, right? I have so many thoughts on that. Even if we have to have this ridiculous security apparatus, what that should be like at the airport, right? You know, I think anyone who makes the process of getting on an airplane 20% faster deserves like a $1 billion prize. Okay, I think
there's well, I mean, there are people that are working on aspects of that. I mean, in most smartphones, you know, there are apps that allow you to have a boarding pass on your smartphone, so you don't have to go to the desk. You can just wave your iPhone next to a reader or whatever, and board the plane. That's helpful. That's that cuts down on
things like that are very helpful.
One small aspect of it. So
it's great that I never have to look for a monitor anymore, right? I just bring up Google and I say the name of the flight and it tells me what gate it's at. Stuff like that is awesome. Yeah, those little incremental improvements that have occurred over time. But I think if we actually focused on the acceleration aspect, we could. And rewarded it, you know, celebrated it, really made it something that we paid attention to. I think we could make even more progress than we have in a lot of these things. So I don't know that this one rates being, you know, evaluated from a standpoint. We could do it if we wanted, right? It's a 100% achievable. All you need is for, you know, I'll put up $100 right now if somebody wants to compete for an acceleration. but this is a doable thing, and I would like to see maybe Singularity University get behind something like this, or a group like that, behind actually recognizing and rewarding big contributions to accelerating processes.
Absolutely.
I think it's an extremely important pursuit. How are we doing on time? Well, we're gonna run out of time, Stephen, before we hit all these.
Yeah, that happens. That happens. Maybe we should accelerate, Phil. So.
And there you go. All right. Well, I had another one that's closely related, and this was a push prize for the biggest contribution to datafication. And in fact, these two might be two sides of the same coin, the more I think about it.
Yeah.
But or ephemeralization. Basically, who's made the biggest contribution this year to pushing the real world into the data world? Now, some people would object to that being described as necessarily virtuous, because maybe we want some things to stay in the real world. And the suggestion here isn't that everything always has to end up becoming datafied, but that we're in this process of doing it. And there are tremendous gains that we seem to achieve every time we do it. I mean, this is the, you know, we've talked at length about how advantageous it is to have a smartphone today versus basically a room full of devices back in the 70s or 80s. And it's because of the datafication of those items. They've all been turned into data propositions. And really, doesn't this kind of swing us back? You know, where are the possibilities? They're in the data. And, you know, how are we making the world better? By turning things back into data. It's kind of an interesting turnaround on the same idea there. But I talk about, for example, Netflix. They might have been up for one of these prizes, right, when they said, we're going to quit with the discs. We're going to phase discs out, and the whole thing's going to be on the computer. Right? I don't know that that made the world better, but it really gave us a new paradigm for entertainment, didn't it? I mean, that was a huge shift, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and you know, and it sort of served as a model for other things. You know, there are all-you-can-eat plans now for not just things like Netflix, where you watch as much as you like, but also books. You know, Amazon they have a plan for your Kindle where you can. I mean, just an unlimited amount of books. You have to – it's like 4 or 5 a month kind of plan, and you have to turn in a book before you can get another book at times. But, you know, that's cool. That is really cool.
That is awesome.
And, of course, you got all you can eat with music is really killing iTunes. Isn't it funny? I mean, iTunes killed the record stores. Now iTunes is being killed by things like RDIO.
By the streaming services,
which is,
yeah.
The streaming services, that's the way people want to listen to their music. You remember we had this argument a while back about, you know, owning music versus, I said, Phil, I don't want to own music. I want to listen to music. You know, that's the thing. I want to be able to explore the world. I want I want all the music in the world, and allow me to have all of it, and I will decide what I want to hear that way. And as opposed to just purchasing what's popular, you know, because you can't purchase it all. So
right.
it allows exploration and discovery in ways that was just not possible with previous models. And so it's eating iTunes lunch. And so, you know, Apple has responded. They're rolling out or have rolled out a or in the
iTunes
process,
Radio.
Whatever.
I listen to it all the time. I love iTunes Radio.
Yep.
Although I think that you reach a point, because it's true. It's like, it's great to listen to the streaming services, and probably it is going to cut everybody's purchases way down. But then sometimes you just want to hear a certain song, right? And you can't do that with the streaming service. You know, it's like, I really want to hear this. Then you want that one on your device, right? It's like, okay, I have to buy this one because I want to hear it sometimes, you know. But
Pandora is a streaming is a free streaming service that you know, it's like a radio, right? That you just listen to.
Yeah.
RDIO is everything. You know, it's the world. If you want to listen to a specific song, you can. You just, you know, but RDIO is a pay service. You know, you're paying every month.
Yeah.
And the way they pay their artists is, you know, is much like the old radio model. You know, if we play your song, we've got to pay you a certain amount of money, right? Based on the number of times we play your song. Well, that's, you know, how many times you know, are people streaming your particular song, Taylor Swift? Then we will pay you because you're, you know, a lot more than we pay this little indie band, but you're both available.
Right.
You know, and this little indie band doesn't give as much because they're not being, you know, they're not being played as much. So that's the way those services work. So, yeah,
very cool.
RDIO is the one that I use, and it's I enjoy it. It's a good service.
Well, I think that, you know, when you take it back one step before the music example, because I think the music example is fantastic, but the book example is really cool because you have kind of a two-staged datafication that that Amazon pulled off there with the world. First, by introducing
right.
the Kindle and putting books on there to begin with was huge. And then, introducing that rental model, which is kind of like the library. You know, so you have the analog to the library, the analog to listening to the radio, just a different consumption model. You can, you can have a book for a while and then you don't have it anymore, which is, people are used to that idea. I mean, you know, that's how it used to work. You go to the library, you read a book. Well, you don't necessarily need it in your house. You've got enough books already. So you move on with your life and next month you read a different book or next month you read through other books. So it's this datafication, not only of the information, but kind of the whole process, isn't it? That's occurred there, and it's made so much more content available and given people so many more choices. I think if Apple and these other services and Amazon hadn't been making tons of money off this anyhow, they would have deserved a prize for putting those together. Okay, I have one last one, which is closely related to the other two we were just talking about, which was a roadmap for post-scarcity. Now, I had a great comment on Facebook from Peter Rothman, the editor of H Plus Magazine. He said, you know, you can't really do a roadmap for some place you've never been before. He said the roadmap analogy isn't really right. But the idea is, we talk about this quite a bit, you know, we know where we are now, and we have a really good picture in broad strokes of where we want to end up, right, in terms of how we want the world to work. Everybody has enough of everything. We've got machines outputting stuff. Nobody really has to work if they don't want to, and post-scarcity, right? We understand
sexy, the immortal billionaires with superpowers, right?
Thank you. That's a good summary right there. That's how I would put it. That's where we want to be.
That's how you have put it.
Yeah, exactly. How do we get from here to there, right? That's the problem, you know? It's like there's a black box in between, and I think we need to start scoping that out a little better. Maybe it's not a roadmap. And maybe it, too, would be a set of push prizes. Maybe we need to start recognizing and awarding people who are putting us on that road, right, who are introducing the major pillars on which post-scarcity are going to rest. And I'm not even sure what those are, and I'm not even sure how that would be certified. So, this, you know, I'm talking at a fairly high level of abstraction here, but I think it's something we absolutely have to do, or else – as you pointed out, we're in for some worrying times ahead, aren't we?
Yeah. It's an explosion of opportunities, but also, you know, with opportunities, you know, come problems. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, there it is. Okay, we kind of glossed over the last few, but we got them all in. I think that's the important thing. And what's our music this evening?
Turn Around and Go by Downtown Mystic.
Turn Around and Go by Downtown Mystic. Well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thank you all for being with us and joining us in our little journey into the possible. Be sure and join us next week. We're going to be joined by Luis Arana. He is an artificial intelligence developer. He's working on an AI right in his own living room. Her name is Luna, and she will be joining us on the show as well, so you will not want to miss that. And until next time, live to see it.
'cause it's now on.